for an entire generation, people have experienced Star Wars the only way it's been possible, on the TV screen. But if you've only seen it this way, you haven't seen it at all.
This is the podcast you're looking for.
We've been waiting for you.
The Force is strong here, even stronger than the coffee.
Welcome to Coffee with Kenobi. Here are your hosts, Dan Z and Corey Klug.
Hello, this is Dan Z, and welcome to show number 17 of Coffee with Kenobi, the Star Wars podcast that analyzes our favorite saga in a whole new way. With me is my good friend and co-host, Corey Klug.
Hey, everybody. Be sure to check out Coffee with Kenobi blogger Becca Benjamin on the newest Cantina Cast. Becca joins Mike and Joe to discuss Anakin Skywalker, a subject near and dear to her own heart. We love seeing our Coffee with Kenobi family sharing their voice and Star Wars fandom. We also want to welcome Darth T-Bone himself, Troy Metzler, to our blogging family. His first blog discusses the evolution of vehicles in the Star Wars galaxy. Check out his blog, as well as all the amazing bloggers we have in our show notes and on our website.
In today's show, we are happy to share a cup of coffee with Paul McDonald. Paul is the author of The Star Wars Heresies, an amazing book you will not be able to put down. It covers important and insightful themes throughout the prequel trilogy. If you thought we have analyzed the prequels before, stay tuned to hear Paul bring even more analysis and intrigue. We also have the next offering of your espresso shot with the Bearded Trio with Rob Wainfer.
We'll also update you regarding Episode 7 filming, the return of Star Wars Reads Day, discuss the victor of This Is Madness, some controversy surrounding it, and much more. We'll introduce our topic for show number 18, and now, let's see what's brewing in the Star Wars universe this week.
Oh wait, this is interesting.
You found something.
Our first news story is, at this point, is probably not news, but we haven't discussed it yet on our show, but Episode 7 is actually filming. Alan Horn had an interview that you can watch on our website. Thanks again to Lisa for being on top of all this great stuff. So it's very exciting. Of course, we still don't have any major casting announcements or any announcements. The only one we know for sure that's going to be in is R2-D2. And of course, there are rumors out there, but all we know for sure is that we're actually having Star Wars films. And this is something that it's really fun, Corey, when you have a blog and a podcast that you really enjoy being a part of. But we know that somewhere in the world right now, Episode 7 is being filmed, which is really cool.
Absolutely, Dan. And I think even though they haven't announced any casting, they haven't really announced any locations or any part of the storyline, it's nice to know that they have the casting is kind of finalized on their end, that the script is in place. They're actually filming scenes that will be used in the film. And I think it's good that we cannot really know anything right now because it won't ruin it right now. I think they're doing a great job of keeping things secret, keeping things under wraps because as fans, we're going to sit there and pull those things apart once we hear those announcements. And it's good that they're just kind of putting out pieces for us to get excited for because, you know, we're getting new films. And like we always say around here, we don't like to talk about rumors and stuff until it's official. As far as the filming goes, I mean, they obviously are doing, you know, set scenes and things like that. Maybe some just location scenes and things like that. But it's exciting to know that it's going on in our fandom as it is right now, because it's a great time to be a Star Wars fan.
The best.
Our next news story has to do with the annual Star Wars Reads Day. This is the third annual Star Wars Reads Day. It'll be held on October 11th, 2014 this year. Looks like Disney broke this news worldwide about a week ago or so, and they got quite a few different publishing groups underneath them. Of course, Del Rey, Dark Horse, and Disney themselves are putting a lot of stuff out. Quark Books came out the wonderful Star Wars Shakespeare books, and a lot of other publishing companies are coming out with some great stuff to fill a tie-in with the Star Wars Rebels animated series, a lot of Lucasfilm franchise stuff, and of course Disney stuff as well.
It's going to be cool, and I think last year when this came out, our show was just a few months in, and we're just very much kind of learning what we're doing. We probably still are to a certain extent, but I think that it would be fun if we went somewhere and did some live broadcasting to celebrate Star Wars Reads. What do you think?
Absolutely. I mean, our local library would probably have some fun things going on, I would hope. Maybe bookstores, Barnes & Noble, things like that. Looks like a lot of our friends from the show, John Jackson Miller, We have Ian Desher is going to be involved with some of the events, maybe around the nation, things. So get your eyes open and keep glued to our website. So we'll be announcing some things as far as some of that going on, so you can join in along with this great event.
Speaking of Ian Desher, my second blog for StarWars.com came out, and it was very, very cool. And maybe the coolest thing about it was that I got to have Ian Desher come in and talk to three of my freshman classes about iambic pentameter and Shakespeare and Romeo and Juliet and The Empire Striketh Back. And the kids were so excited. It's not every day that you get to come to school and talk to a New York Times bestselling author. And Ian was so great, so personable. I hope to have him on very soon talking about The Empire Striketh Back and The Jedi Doth Return. But believe it or not, Corey, not only does he do a great Obi-Wan, but his Yoda is practically Tom Kane or Frank Oz. And I did talk about that in the blog, but he was good, and he just did it like it was a natural thing. He's such a cool guy, and thanks again to StarWars.com and everybody over at Lucasfilm for allowing me the opportunity to write about this experience. Anytime you get to write about Star Wars on StarWars.com, it's a huge thrill, and we even had our friends from the Wookiee Gunner and Star Wars Kids cast on, as they got to write some blogs on StarWars.com. So it's just so cool that in this time period when Star Wars is just everywhere, it's all over the place, it's ubiquitous, and fandom is getting involved in ways that we never got a chance to before. And to me, as long as Star Wars is around and we're around, as long as Star Wars is around, the more fans that get involved and contribute to fandom and to the zeitgeist of Star Wars culture, the better this community is.
Well said, dude.
Our third story is the end of This Is Madness tournament. It was pretty exciting, and it was cool for us because who wins, Corey?
Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Obi-Wan Kenobi himself. And James Arnold Taylor, always, the gamer of fandom, and he's just so awesome and so enthusiastic. And he recorded himself talking about Obi-Wan winning, and he had a picture of himself surrounded by a lot of his Obi-Wan Kenobi statues and merchandise. It was just very, very cool. It was a little bit surprising. I mean, 2 years in a row, Darth Vader gets to the championship, and he just can't make it over the hump.
Well, here's something interesting, too. It's nice to see somebody else win for a change, and Obi-Wan Kenobi's really kind of coming to his own as far as the Clone Wars, and his popularity has really risen a lot. And I think that has to do with James Arnold Taylor's portrayal on the show.
Absolutely. He's just such a great ambassador for Star Wars and fandom, and for one of the most popular characters. And I got to be honest, I've always liked Obi-Wan, but since we started doing the show and getting to see people and meet people like James Arnold Taylor and learning more about Obi-Wan Kenobi than John Jackson Miller's great book about Kenobi, I find myself liking him more than I ever thought possible, Obi-Wan Kenobi himself. So the fact that he won, and for 2 years in a row, to see in this world of negativity, there's sometimes not always negative, but in
sure,
this world
sure.
where people are complaining because they want their movies darker, it's cool to see that positivity and the light side come through again. That gives me hope.
It does, and it's kind of nice too, because if you think about it, A New Hope was the first film. The first lightsaber battle we see is between Obi-Wan Kenobi and Darth Vader, and honestly, the whole saga really revolves around Anakin, of course. And honestly, it's really close to Obi-Wan as well. I mean, he's throughout the entire saga, and they're obviously putting each other head-to-head. They're best friends and grew up together, and it's almost like a nice end result as far as them meeting again and battling in our own minds as this tournament goes on. But it's just fun to see it play out and have a great victor.
Before we have our espresso shot with the Bearded Trio, we want to give a huge thank you to Rob Wainford for... He posted an article on thebeardtrio.com featuring all of our bloggers with their logos and a little bit about what their recent blogs have been about. And Rob's been such a great friend and a tremendous to work with. And the fact that he would take the time out of his schedule with his amazing site to talk about our bloggers, we're just so happy and grateful.
And a little behind the scenes information for folks out there. Rob puts together kind of this wallpaper Facebook backgrounds for us for each show, and we didn't ask him to do that. He just went and did it just for the fun of it, and they're incredible. They're a lot of fun. They feature each show and each guest, and we love them. We love seeing that stuff, and he's a great contributor from all the news he gives from us from Lucasfilm, and all the new films are coming out from from Steven Spielberg and John Williams' music and stuff. He's a passionate guy for all those kinds of films and all that music and everything, and we love having him on.
Definitely. Our show is better because of Rob Wainfer.
And now, your espresso shot with the Bearded Trio.
Hi all, welcome to another Espresso Shot with the Bearded Trio with me, Rob Wainfer. Coming up, we've got some Spielberg news, LucasArts news and more, and we'll also be announcing the winner of that excellent LucasArts book, Rogue Leaders. Stay tuned. But let's get straight into it with some news. Now, the latest news on Steven Spielberg is that he's eyeing up Jewish 19th century drama, The Kidnapping of Edgardo Montara. Now, Spielberg is apparently teaming up once again with Tony Kushner, who scribed both Lincoln and Munich, which, of course, Steven Spielberg went on to direct. Now, the project is a religious drama about a Jew in the 19th century who was removed from his parents at the age of 7 by authorities and raised as a Catholic. Now, at this time, it's not said if he will actually direct the movie, but he's definitely penciled it in. And in the past, of course, when he's teamed up with Tony Kushner, he's gone on to direct both Lincoln and Munich. Well, apparently, Steven Spielberg's next directing gig, if you believe the rumours on the internet, will actually be Robopocalypse. Now, Spielberg, you may have heard, had walked away from this project, but apparently after a major rewrite of the script, the director is back on board for the sci-fi film based on the Daniel Wilson novel. And we'll keep you posted on that one. Now, a one-time benefit concert featuring John Williams and Steven Spielberg sold out in record time. Tickets went on sale last Monday at 9 a.m, and within 15 minutes, they were sold out. The event will see John Williams conducting for the Detroit Symphony Orchestra on June the 14th, while Steven Spielberg will be the host for the evening. The event itself is expected to raise about $1 million for the orchestra. Fans began camping out on Sunday night, and by Monday morning, a long line had been formed outside the Max M. Fisher Music Center in Detroit. Now, the orchestra anticipated a large turnout and provided free pizza and donuts to the fans. Now, last time we reported that the mayor of Chicago, Rahm Emanuel, is very eager to see the Lucas Cultural Arts Museum come to the city. And on Thursday, the mayor appointed a 12-people task force that will go out and recommend potential sites in Chicago to see George Lucas and to see his collection of art and movie memorabilia come to the city. Now, the site selected by the mayor will then have to compete against at least one known site in San Francisco. But don't forget that the recently married George Lucas, he married Melody Hobson, and she's actually from Chicago, so Chicago has actually got a very good chance, just as good as San Francisco. We'll keep you posted on all the latest news on the Lucas Cultural Arts Museum. Software developer Redfly were working on a Darth Maul game, which was going to tie in with the Clone Wars TV series. The game would have been a stealth action game and would have been open world, not unlike the Batman Arkham games. Now, the company itself would have brought out the game on PC, Xbox 360, PS3 and the Wii U. Now, IGN write, although the developer aimed to create a Darth Maul origin story in 2010, LucasArts' goal was to link the game, codenamed Damage, to an upcoming season of The Clone Wars. Now, LucasArts allegedly considered purchasing Redfly, and when the buyout didn't happen, LucasArts cancelled Damage in 2011, forcing the studio to let go of 70 employees. That's a shame and bad news all round for the employees there and for us fans as well, because I would love to have seen an open world Star Wars video game in the same style as the Batman Arkham games. The Steven Spielberg executive produced Falling Skies will return to American TVs on June the 22nd. Season 4 will begin. And to whet your appetite, here's a quick teaser.
The nightmare is just beginning.
Wake up.
There's a war. Our family, we have no idea where they are.
We don't all have to die here.
This is a new beginning.
There's no escape.
These are all mine!
From what's coming next.
No! They change us until we barely recognize ourselves as human.
No!
This is the only way, the better way. I want to show you something. The future.
Well, that wraps up another Espresso Shot with the Bearded Trio. Just before I go, I want to congratulate Erin Harris for winning the LucasArts book Rogue Leaders. I'm going to be sending that off to you, Erin, any day now to sunny Florida. So congratulations. So that's it. I'll hand you back to your hosts, Coffee with Kenobi. Thank you for listening. Make sure you check out the Bearded Trio website, beardedtrio.com. And we're also on Facebook and Twitter as well. And that's it. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Han Solo, Rebel Soldier, Lando Calrissian, and Bespin Guard each sold separately from Star Wars The Empire Strikes Back Collection, new from Kenner.
Looking? Found someone you have, I would say,
Your lightsabers will make a fine addition to my collection.
Our first collection news has to do with one of the top items of all fandom, of mostly a lot of fans have been climbing for a long time. It's a 1-1 scale life-size sale of Han Solo and Carbonite, brought to you by Sideshow Toys. They do some wonderful work, awesome stuff. And Dan, this has been on the top of your collector list, since you've been,
Since I was a fetus, Corey. It's been a long time, man. Ever since 1980, I've always wanted to have that. I've been talking to my wife since I met her about someday there's going to be a 1-1 scale Han Solo and Carbonite. I want to get it. I want to put it in the basement. Yeah, baby.
Yeah,
and so I've been saving money for a year. We've been joking about this on the show. And then you get the price tag.
$6,999.00.
Well, you know, in that scene when they're on the Falcon and they're going to Alderaan, and Han Solo and Obi-Wan Kenobi says, like a million voices cried out in terror and were suddenly silenced. That's kind of how my midichlorian count went when I saw the price. Because I've been saving this thing for a year.
Yeah.
Like, literally, I had a fund for this. And then I saw it's $7,000. Are you kidding me? I don't even Tony Stark would think that was expensive. You mentioned a payment plan. And here's what the payment plan is. You put down a deposit of $700, which, you know, I have in my sock drawer. And then every month, starting in May of 2014, all the way through February 2015, just for a cool $629.90 a month.
Yeah, I wonder if that's how much Boba Fett got paid.
I hope he got paid a lot more.
I would think so. Credits. I don't know what the credit to dollars ratio is, but I don't know if that's a good turnover or what.
People have said to me, and I jokingly said I'm going to start a DNZ fund on Twitter. And I've actually, full disclosure, I've reached out to Sideshow a number of times to see if we can get a review copy. And of course, have not heard back from them.
Well, you know, they do what they can.
And here's the thing. If you were going to spend $629 a month for this, how many other things could you do for that? Would you say that from a metaphorical standpoint, if I have a wife and three children and I put $629 a month aside for that, would you say that I would be much like the Han Solo and Carbonite decoration? I would be continually frozen and stilted in my emotional growth that I was putting that money towards that instead of towards my family?
Yeah, I would assume so, and I don't think she would let you out of that shit, so yeah.
Man, it would be so great. Someday, man, someday, but apparently not for a while. And hey, if you are one of the lucky ones that gets one, send us a review, send us pictures. We'll come over and visit, we'll have a picnic.
Have some coffee.
It'll be great. Have some coffee, it'll be awesome.
Hi, I'm Paul McDonald, author of the Star Wars Heresies. And you're listening to Coffee with Kenobi with Dan Z and Corey Club. This is the podcast you're looking for.
Luke, you're going to find that many of the truths we cling to depend greatly on our own point of view.
I must be allowed to speak.
You've taken your first step into a larger world.
Our topic for show number 17 is the Star Wars Heresies. The book examines the themes, motifs, and mythology of the prequels in a way that is both academic as well as entertaining and fascinating. Joining us on this topic is the ultimate guest, author of the Star Wars Heresies, Paul McDonald. Paul is a great friend of the show, as well as a wise and dedicated defender of the Star Wars prequels. It is no stretch to say that between Brian Young and Paul McDonald, You will look at the prequels for the art form they truly are. We are happy to have him join us for a cup of coffee. Welcome, Paul.
Yeah, hi.
Thanks for coming on, Paul. First, we'd like to know what inspired you to write the Star Wars Heresies.
I got to say, first off, just the films themselves. I mean, I saw them all on opening day, of course, and I embraced them as much as I had the original trilogy. I mean, the themes just resonated with me. The characters, actually, I found to be very relatable. I mean, I've been a little bit of Qui-Gon and a little bit of Obi-Wan, a little bit of Padme, maybe even a little bit of Anakin on a bad day. But it just caught me much in the same way the original trilogy did. I hearken back to what Emily Dickinson said about poetry. She knew something was poetry as if she felt as though the top of her head had been taken off, and that's kind of my litmus test for Star Wars. And the prequels made me feel that way. So it was a very natural progression for me, actually. By the time the prequels were coming out, I was getting an English degree. And so I'd spent years learning how to analyze and deconstruct stories and poetry. I mean, for me, Star Wars is a kind of visual poetry. And I think a lot of this goes back to Lucas's days as a film student at USC when he was filming his tone poems back in the day. I mean, Star Wars is not poetry necessarily in the literary sense. We've all heard the complaints about wooden dialogue, especially in the prequels. But there is some poetry in the juxtaposition of the way the music and the visuals work. I mean, for me, it's very easy to read the films in much the same way one would read a literary text. I actually started writing professionally about Star Wars back in the prequel days. Specifically, Space.com was doing a series called The Phantom Heresies, and that's kind of where I obviously nabbed my title from. But it was looking at Star Wars in a very in-depth and a very analytical way, and that really appealed to me. And so I wrote articles for Sweet101.com, for Sci-Fi Dimensions. I've done editorials for TheForce.net. I even inspired a brief editorial series for the old Force cast. So the build-up for the book was pretty long, with all sorts of essays and stuff that, I mean, really, I just worked on for over a decade. And I think a lot of that just goes back to the fact that Lucas's interest in so many things just kind of dovetails into my own, whether we're talking about comparative mythology or Eastern philosophy or what have you. I was already outlining the book by the time I ran into a representative of McFarlane, and they're the people who published the book at Dragon Con. And they expressed some interest, and I got up a synopsis and everything for them and an outline and sent it to them, and they were... So it all just kind of worked out. I mean, for me, largely one of the ways I geek out about Star Wars now is, you know, not really playing with action figures anymore, but just playing with patterns of analysis and symbolism and so forth.
I don't have my MLS, but I'm a library associate, and I was talking to Brian Young at Dragon Con, and I was basically explaining, yeah, I'm the Jocasta New of, you know, GCDL. And then he was like, but Jocasta New is a terrible librarian. And I'm like, yeah, she really kind of was. I mean, her model reference behavior was, you know, I mean, if I was like that, can you imagine me at the desk? Like, well, you know, if a book doesn't appear in our catalog, it doesn't exist.
I'm curious to know the length of time it took to do research for this book. Did you watch the movies over and over again, or was you do research? Or how was that done?
Wow. You know, well, I was an English major, so I think I've been pretty much doing research ever since then. It's as I said, I started kind of writing down the saga while I was in college. So it was like, you know, senior seminar on James Joyce and then go up to Attack of the Clones. And somehow in my weird mind, it all just sort of comes together. And as I said, I really got interested in, I took a lot of philosophy in college, and I took obviously a lot of English literature, and I took a lot of mythology and all that sort of thing and storytelling. So basically that kind of prepped me for this and for this whole journey. I mean, I've been out of college a while now, but that's the impetus that sort of set it all into motion for me. As far as research goes, Star Wars for me, it just kind of goes hand in hand with all this sort of thing. I mean, as George Lucas has always said, Star Wars isn't about Star Wars just becoming your life. It's about, you know, opening yourself up to new things and, again, taking that first step into a larger world and all that sort of good stuff. So it was kind of the gateway drug, actually, to a lot of various intellectual pursuits.
I'm a big fan of the whole English major avenue. So, and that's just, like you said, it's just exactly. Sort of a natural progression. When you're studying things you're passionate about, then you start to see threads and commonalities in everything that you're studying, that you're watching, that you're enjoying. And probably one of the hottest topics for the prequels, and we're just going to jump right into your book because it's just so rich and so full of fascinating insights into the prequels, but maybe the one that's at least prevalent on my mind is midichlorians. Can you kind of talk about your views on midichlorians and what you say in the book about them, as well as how your insights have evolved as you've reflected on them over time?
Sure. I've never had a problem with midichlorians. I think my first exposure to the whole midichlorian issue was actually reading a magazine, and it had an interview with Liam Neeson in it. And he was talking about midichlorians. He was talking about a scene that was kind of difficult for him to execute, essentially, where he had all the scientific gobbledygook, as he said. And then he had George Lucas explain it to him. And I remember something, I think it was Seth Green at Celebration 6. Unfortunately, I didn't get to see this panel, but Seth Green was talking about working on Detours with George Lucas. And after George, they were kind of writing him a little bit about the whole midichlorian issue. And after he talked to him for like 30 minutes, they're like, midichlorians are awesome. We love midichlorians. So apparently George Lucas can explain it, you know, a lot better. and I've read a lot of stuff in interviews that he's given and so on and so forth about midichlorians. I mean, for me, we know from the original trilogy that at least Force ability is transmitted via bloodlines, at least to a certain extent. The Force runs strong in your family and all that sort of good stuff. So if there's something actually in your blood that just kind of makes you more of a conduit for the Force, I mean, that's not a big issue for me. And as I noted in the book, the Force is essentially created by the physical world, by the biological world. You know, it's a life force, as George Lucas has said, so that you don't really have that. It makes sense to me that there would be this connection between, you know, the biological world and the spiritual world.
Now, of course, the question, though, is do people say that takes away from the spirituality of the Force?
Well, again, not for me. I mean, as it's been said many times, I mean, midichlorians actually aren't the Force. They're just that conduit. They're like, basically a radio antenna for the Force that kind of tunes you into it. I know some people have had issues as far as just the fact that it was transmitted through bloodlines, and that, you know, it's almost like some kind of a caste system where you have, you know, this chosen group of people who can use it and no one else can. And that's kind of been part of the canon since the very beginning. And, you know, and the Force is just as mysterious and ineffable as it always was, just because you have, again, some kind of an organic link to it. I mean, as I talk about a little in the book, the Force is kind of an organism, you know, in its own right, as something that grows out of the natural world.
True.
So,
I'm sure you knew how much this is such a highly looked upon topic. Was this one of the more challenging chapters to write, or was this one of the easier ones?
No, I was so ready to go. When I finally got around to writing it, honestly, I broke the book up into three different parts, you know, one part for each movie in the prequel trilogy. So honestly, the Phantom Menace part was probably about the easiest 100 pages that I've ever written on anything. And I've written a couple of young adult books and all that sort of stuff. But it really, really, like I said, I was just so primed and I was so stoked for it. I guess I just and debated with people about it and so on and so forth so much that actually that part came really, really easily to me.
That's great. Another thing that I think a lot of people talk about as far as when they talk about the prequels is the character of Jar Jar. And you've got a great chapter on that. What makes Jar Jar essential to the prequel trilogy?
You know, speaking of Jar Jar, I was thinking about doing this whole thing in like Gungan speak, but it took us long enough to get the Skype thing figured out. So yeah, maybe that would be balanced a little bit. How is he essential to the prequel trilogy?
Yeah, well, you make a beautiful argument with the Frog Prince that we have an email we're going to share later with our friend Craig. Talk about how he's so essential.
Well, he's a central plot. I mean, if you look at the plot of A New Hope, say like Chewbacca in A New Hope, who we all love. Jar Jar is more essential to the plot of The Phantom Menace. Want a straight up as a straight up plot point. Again, he is the conduit that unites, that puts the idea in Queen Amidala's head in Coruscant that the Gungans have an army and that in point of fact, that they can go back to Naboo and they can actually take care of this problem with the Trade Federation themselves, that they don't necessarily have to rely on the bureaucracy of the Republic, with wasn't doing any good anyway. Actually, I really like the way those scenes are played out in The Phantom Menace, because you have, you know, Qui-Gon Jinn and Obi-Wan going to the Jedi Council and basically being shut down by their little Jedi bureaucracy as far as Chosen One, and you've got Emergence in the Force and the Sith maybe back, and they're just sort of not listening. And then you have Amidala, you know, in the Senate chamber in that awesome scene, basically being just shoved aside by bureaucracy as well. So that's how essential Jar Jar is to the particular plot of that movie. And then, of course, as you get into Attack of the Clones, he unfortunately kind of sets much of the machinations of the of the Empire into motion there.
It does.
Inadvertently, of course. But just from a, you know, I just back to George Lucas, I think it was an interview that he gave during the special edition, when he was working on the special editions back in the 90s. And he said, you know, a lot of Star Wars is plot stuff, and a lot of stuff is whimsy that he just kind of put in there of his own, you know, whimsical nature. And I think Jar Jar is certainly a good representation of that. Jar Jar makes me laugh every now and again. So, and I never had a problem with it. It was difficult kind of understanding what he was saying always. But, you know, I thought he had a couple of really good lines. And I'm thinking about the scene in the bongo when he's monsters out there and leaking in here. When are you so thinking we're in trouble? I don't know. That one always makes me laugh. It's like, yeah, things are about as bad as I get. You know, and I think he works really well in those scenes, actually, because he's just kind of juxtaposed against these Jedi that are just have the whole stoic, you know, zen cool sort of thing going on. And I think he works really well there. So I never had an issue with him. It just kind of makes me laugh. I mean, that's kind of my relationship with Star Wars. It's just, you know, it's just something to kick back and relax with and laugh about. And then on the other side of it, you know, if you want to get really deep and analytical, that, you know, you can do that too. It works for me on both levels.
It's so rich in so many ways. And I like to share with all of our listeners an email from Craig Dickinson, our good friend of the show. And he writes, guys, so excited that Paul is finally on the show. It's the perfect fit, as the Star Wars Heresies hits many of the same notes as Coffee with Kenobi does. Paul's book cannot be glossed through or read quickly, or one runs the risk of flying right by something that could change one's whole outlook on the prequel films. For instance, Paul repeatedly refers to George Lucas's own assertion that the Star Wars saga is poetry, and that's the stanzas rhyme, which is a maxim I use as the basis of teaching Star Wars with the prequels as flashback order. When it came time to share my favorite parts of the book, I was love it all. But ultimately, I decided to bring up just two items from this great book. Preface on page 4. Paul points out that the symbolism of Anakin descending to the Tusken camp from a high above star-filled night raid before he's consumed by his rage and temporarily the dark side. Parallel Lucifer from the old, Anakin is shown to be literally and figuratively fallen out of heaven. And it, as a side note, when I read that out loud, I read that to my wife and I actually said, wow, out loud, because that's great.
Nice, thank you.
So in part 2, he says, in chapter 9, Paul gives us an in-depth analysis of Jar Jar Binks and brings up many connections I was shocked I'd never thought of. In this section, we are reminded that because Gungans are frog-like, they appeal to small children, but often are repulsive to adults. Even deeper, Jar Jar and the Golden City of Utagunga are Prince fairy tale, where first impressions are proven wrong. But my favorite bit from this chapter is the reference to Jar Jar's purpose in The Phantom Menace of helping to bring the Naboo and the Gungans together. And because he's an amphibian, he's able to walk comfortably in both worlds, mind officially, if only figuratively blown. And then he goes on to say how much he's looking forward to hearing our conversation and Paul's amazing book. And Paul, those are certainly some insights that I really appreciated about. And we talked about this when Brian Young was on, but mm-hmm. One of the neat things about Jar Jar is that he really is, he does serve certain roles. I never thought about the fact that he's more impactful to the overall arc of the story than Chewbacca is to the original trilogy. But he really was, he was perfectly made for kids, and kids love him. That's the first time I saw Phantom Menace. Things that bothered me about the Phantom Menace had nothing to do with Jar Jar. I thought he was fine.
Yeah, I mean, I remember the creator, or not the creators, but rather the current producers of Doctor Who talking about just how important it was if they're going to create a monster or something to give something that kids can actually like emulate on the playground the next day. And, you know, Jar Jar is kind of a perfect example of that. I remember Stephen Aleppo, who was a Jungian scholar, who wrote, I don't know if you're familiar with it, it's The Journey of Luke Skywalker, I believe. It's kind of the original trilogy, but from a Jungian perspective.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh.
No, I didn't know about that.
Oh, yeah. And I think actually it was in my book. He wrote a really nice review of The Phantom Menace. And he was talking about, yeah, the next day at the dinner table, his two kids were totally, you know, imitating Jar Jar the whole time and having a great time with that. So, yeah, I mean, it's Star Wars just appeals to so many different age groups. And point of fact, I work in a library, as y'all probably know. And I was talking to my branch manager today about doing a Star Wars event, Star Wars Read Today or something like that. And, you know, one of the issues was, well, what is the age, you know, the library system likes to know what is the age group for? And it's like, I mean, it's Star Wars. It's, you know, anywhere from 8 to 80.
Right.
So.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, and this is a well-worn analogy as well, but it's like Luke going into the cave on Dagobah and it's like, what's in or whatever you take with you. Star Wars is much the same way. You know, I mean, it just tends to meet you or you meet it. That's been my experience anyway.
Absolutely.
And it, actually, when you're talking about the cave, I thought about that last week. When I was in church, they were talking about living by the sword and dying by the sword. And I instantly thought about,
oh, wow.
Empire Strikes Back. Yeah.
Yeah.
Only what you take with you. And maybe I should have been focusing more on my faith in church. But Star Wars came up, you know.
as it does.
That, as George Lucas has said, you know, it's not about Star Wars becoming a surrogate religion or anything. But that was some of the questions that he wanted kids to start thinking about. You know, as he said, I'm thinking of the interview we did in Time magazine with Bill Moyers. I don't know if you guys have seen any of that stuff, but it's really great.
Oh yeah, fantastic.
So some people are opposed to like pop culture working that way at all. But I mean, pop culture is just sort of everywhere. Is, you know, my goodness, with the internet and social media and everything else. So when you actually have something that has some depth to it, has some resonance, you know, and that can lead you down some interesting paths, that, you know, I certainly think you should follow them.
Definitely. And one of the key things that we have when we talk about the prequels, clearly it's Anakin's story. And I was right. I was happy that you covered him, different phases of his life in the prequels. Can you take us through your process of analyzing Anakin's journey from episodes 1 to 3? And what makes Anakin an effective catalyst for adding to Lucas's vision?
My process with Anakin was pretty much the process I went through with everybody, which was, I take a lot of notes, and I still take a lot of notes. Even when I'm not necessarily working on something, I'm still just taking notes perpetually. It's just kind of taking all that and seeing what I can apply to where. So Anakin's journey, one thing I did want to kind of, well, this is maybe a little ancillary to your question, but I did want to get into, you guys mentioned the whole Joseph Campbell and poetry angle. And I think that's really, really yes. interesting. Not necessarily, I mean, I did not want to do just a paint by the numbers, you know, hero's journey type thing where, you know, Anakin has a miraculous birth and he meets, you know, a mystical mentor. And that has been done so often, I think, particularly in terms of the original trilogy. But I love Joseph Campbell's whole take on mythology as poetry. And again, as an English major, you know, maybe not the most marketable major, but nonetheless, it does teach you to think in a very metaphorical way, and it does teach you to think in a symbolic way.
Absolutely.
You know, just lots of meanings that point beyond themselves. And so that's kind of what I keyed into it. I mean, obviously, Hero's Journey plays into Anakin a lot. Yeah, it's been a long time since I've written the book.
So. Well, you look and you discuss him in episode 1, and then you look at him in 2, and then you look at 3, and you just sort of talk about his growth, you know, the hero's journey, and then his classic fall too.
Right, and just the whole letting go thing, and his inability to let go. And again, I just always harken back to George Lucas. You know, it's funny, if you actually go back to what George Lucas says, there really is a remarkable consistency to all this sort of thing. It, you know, as opposed to all these people who try to like outthink George Lucas and outmaneuver George Lucas, and it should have been this way or that way. You know, I didn't create Star Wars, so I don't really know how it should have went, or, you know, I just kind of deal with what we were dealt, which I, you know, really resonated with me. But George Lucas has said,
absolutely.
Yeah. George Lucas has said that Star Wars is about letting go. And so there's a fair amount of about that in the book. And this kind of gets into the whole Jedi non-attachment thing, which I listened to you guys show. It's really, really good. Yeah, and that's another topic that really, really seemed to throw people a lot. So I come from, I just have a lot of experience and influence in Eastern philosophy. So I kind of get the Jedi non-attachment thing and kind of where they were coming from. I think non-attachment actually comes from, it's translated kind of badly from a Sanskrit word. I believe it's klesha, and it was translated as non-attachment. There really is no good Western translation of it. Maybe like clinging or craving would be, I was reading a book by Thich Nhat Hanh, and I don't think he ever brought up non-attachment maybe one time, but basically usually just defined it as clinging or craving. And I think that's kind of what the Jedi were going for. I know in the chapter that I start the section of Revenge of the Sith on, the fall, and just this, the relationship we have with death, just the idea that we are, in fact, that we are self-conscious and that we know that we're going to die one day, and just kind of the impact that's had on human culture. I'm trying to remember exactly. I remember Joseph Campbell actually talking about maybe death being the central theme of mythology. I remember J.K. Yes. Rowling of Harry Potter basically saying, you know, death may be like the theme of Harry Potter. And it's kind of the same way with Star Wars and Anakin's inability to deal with that. I was reading through the making of Revenge of the Sith, which incidentally is a great book, J.W. Rinsler.
A terrific book, yes.
Yeah. It's the one that really started him off on his all his great making of books that he's done so far. Well, I like the example that he gave. It was really interesting at the very end when Vader threw Palpatine down the at the end of Return of the Jedi and just kind of labeled that as this great act of non-attachment. You know, that he was letting go of everything. He was literally and figuratively throwing away the dark side, right? and all that anger and greed and power that he was addicted to, just throwing it away. I mean, that's a really positive example of non-attachment. Like I said, craving, clinging, maybe would be a better word.
That makes much more sense too. That they would encourage people not to be clingy or to be almost obsessive over it, but it's okay to have emotions and to love, which I think again that Luke is the one who, I don't know if I want to say perfects that, but it brings it back into the light, so to speak.
Certainly, I tend to think of Qui-Gon Jinn and Luke Skywalker as kind of like the bookends of the Jedi across the entire saga. That. Yeah, I think they got it on the level that, you know, most of the other Jedi, let's face it, just didn't get it. Maybe even Obi-Wan. Those are pretty much my favorite characters. But same here. Yeah. So it's more of, you know, the Jedi are allowed to love people. As Lucas said, they should love everybody. They should even love the Sith, you know, love their enemies. You're just not allowed to possess people. You're not allowed to cling to them. You're not allowed to turn them into an object. And then as I get into a little bit in the book, when you have this kind of deeper metaphysical ground of the Force, you have something that is connecting everybody anyway. So from more of an Eastern standpoint, it's like you're trying to turn someone into an object that you're already really, really connected to, that you're interdependent with, and that this kind of ties into the whole, you know, symbiosis theme in the Phantom Menace.
Right.
And so in other words, it doesn't make any sense to be attached to them. It's like, you know, it's like being attached to your right hand, you know, it's like, well, that it's just a part of you. Unless of course it gets chopped off by a lightsaber, which maybe that's a bad example here.
It seems to be a popular motif.
Yeah, really. I didn't write that much about, you know, being dismembered. Actually, I think Stephen Gallipo, the European scholar I was talking about, talks about, you know, at the end of Revenge of the Sith, Anakin is literally is cut off from himself. You know, he's cut off from other people, but he's literally cut off from himself. So again, you have the literal and the metaphorical coming together in a nice way there. But yeah, so I think that's where the Jedi are coming from. It's like, you know, everybody is bound in the Force, everybody is one in the Force, and if you just cling on to this one person or this one idea or what have you, it's back to the death theme. I mean, everybody's going to die. Everybody, you know, every season has its hour, but it is changed. And as Shmi Skywalker so eloquently put it, you can't stop the suns from setting. So that's a great image right there, actually, of just trying to stop the impossible. And you know, when you just want to set your own will against, you know, the will of God or the Force or the universe or whatever you want to call it. I think the Jedi were on the right track. I just think they didn't necessarily explain it in the right way. I mean, Dan, you're a teacher, so you know, you have to kind of format your message for, you know, your students. And Yoda didn't really do that for Anakin in Revenge of the Sith. He just kind of gave him straight up, you know, the Jedi dogma, and obviously Anakin was not going to listen to that. And it's, again, just the clinging thing. It sets up a lot of anxiety. It sets up a lot of suffering.
Because you're taught to go against, fighting against your natural human instinct and your natural human drives and passions. So when you're already trying to be something bigger than yourself, but you're also told to ignore a part of who you are, it's no wonder there's so much conflict within Anakin.
Yeah. I mean, he's you know, very sympathetic in that way, I think. And then that scene at the end, I mean, in the middle of Attack of the Clones, after he slaughters the Tuskens and he's confessing to Padme and is, you know, he's, I'm a Jedi, I know I'm better than this. And again, just trying to strive for that ideal, but and being tortured by it at the same time and being driven in so many different directions.
To strive for perfection. To strive for perfection is an excellent way to increase anxiety.
Oh, sure. Exactly. And maybe if you're raised in the Jedi Temple, you know, from birth, you know, the Jedi obviously had a lot of flaws and they were very much trapped by their own dogma and they were blind by their own arrogance. I'm not sure they were entirely off base as far as some of their thinking goes, even as far as is taking kids, you know, and raising them in this temple. You know, it's, I think I remember Kyle Newman talking about, you know, the Sith, that like, well, of course, the Sith want you out in the real world. You know, they want you to be kicked around a little bit. They want you, you know, they want you to be bullied and put down and, you know, have disappointments and all this sort of thing, because it makes you prime Sith bait, right?
That's good. Yeah,
absolutely.
We got a couple more questions here. Now, I know a lot of people downplay the prequels, kind of put it as more of like a marketing scheme by Lucas, but why should fans and the audiences take another look at the prequels?
Well, I remember you guys had Brian Young on, and yeah. I talked a little bit about I really hope that people didn't just go see The Phantom Menace like one time and then like, well, this is crap, and didn't live up to my
right.
expectations and never saw it again. I mean, let's go back to the poetry thing again. I had a great English professor who actually started the Chattahoochee Review. It's a scholarly journal here in near Atlanta. And he always talked about poetry, and like the first time you just read it and you basically just kind of let it sink in and you get the rhythm and you get the feeling for it. And then, you know, maybe the second or the third time you go back and read it and, you know, you get more and more levels out of it and more and more. I mean, honestly, so I that's kind of the way I approach Star Wars, only obviously I watch it quite a watch it a heck of a lot more times than two.
Yeah.
And twice. but that is how kind of how I approach a lot of things. I find just a lot of films, sometimes even books, it's like, you know, they're well worth exploring a second time, because there's so much. Again, let's go back to the attachment issue and talk about that in relation to fandom, because I kind of, you know, I think this fandom has real attachment issues sometimes. You know, it's like they've been building up the Phantom Menace in their head for 15, 16 years, and then it doesn't meet their expectations, and you know, you're just kind of lost in that. Fear leads to anger leads to hate, hate leads to suffering. I mean, it's, but yeah, that is like the really negative meaning of the word, of attachment, of, you know, you're building something up into an ideal in your head, and then the reality sets in, whether it's, you know, whether it's a movie or whether it's, you know, another human being or what have you, and they don't live up to this expectation or whatever that you have of them. And then, you know, you just reject it and you spew, in this case, you know, hatred and anger all over the internet. And then again, that kind of leads to our suffering, and that leads to the suffering on the people who who type it all up. So, yeah, I think that that's a really good example. And you know, even back to the special editions, I have my qualms and criticisms of the special editions and the prequels. I think everything about evens out for me when, you know, when all's said and done. But I think some fans just, you know, they basically just want to take their VHS copy of The Empire Strikes Back and freeze it in carbonite and just, you know, mount it on the wall. And then, you know, this can't change this, you know, again, they're trying to stop the suns from setting, so to say. And again, if you go back to your source material, you know, Joseph Campbell, he constantly talks about that mythology is a very fluid, changing entity. You know, I mean, what story you hear.
Good point. I never thought about it like that.
Yeah, it's what story you hear. It depends on you. What village that you were standing in at the time. And as Joseph Campbell always, you know, talked about canon, it's like, you know, it's like unless Star Wars is in danger of becoming a religion, we, you know, the canon arguments are really, really get a little old for me. So, I kind of like that it changes things. I like that, you know, George Lucas always alluded to the fact that The Phantom Menace, in point of fact, was going to ruin some people's childhoods. That, you know, it was totally going to play with their expectations, and it was going to turn everything on its head. And like I said, I have my own writing and stuff that I do, so I'm not always trying to just outthink and outguess George Lucas when it comes to all this stuff. So I guess maybe that makes it a little easier for me to be blown away. Because, you know, and people just absolutely hated the execution of the prequels, they just kind of hated the execution, and that's there's nothing that I can do to change that, or that anybody can do to change it. You know, I mean, the execution for me worked fine for the most part. I thought a lot of people that just fit dead on. I mean, I Liam Neeson is somebody who just kind of fit in the Star Wars galaxy dead on, and you had Ewan McGregor as great Obi-Wan, and somebody like Christopher Lee, and Ian McDiarmid. You had some pretty solid acting going on. And yeah, as far as the writing, I thought you had some very memorable lines and all that sort of good stuff. So it's, yeah, I don't know. Now I really am rambling. Apologies, but
No. This is awesome. Everything you're saying is really great.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, it took me a while.
And that's why we wanted to have you on the show, because all good things come to those who wait, right? So when I'm reading this and analyzing it, it really is like you took a master's class, and it is a master's class in Star Wars and mythology, to be the textbook that the professor would hand you, because the things that you are looking at, it's clearly not something you did in passing. It's clearly there's a lot of knowledge and forethought and insights and research into it, and your notes and your references really can point viewers and readers to a lot of different directions. So I certainly appreciate that. And it really is important that people who are Star Wars fans, who love analyzing and interpreting Star Wars, which I would certainly think is a major thing for our listeners at Coffee with Kenobi, and we're grateful for that because we love it too.
Oh,
so
yeah.
How can people get a copy of this amazing book?
It's an amazing book. It's full of words and paragraphs and punctuation marks. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, don't even get. And I've actually written a couple of young adult novels, so that's probably actually what I'm going to do next. I haven't. Yeah, I have you now. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, where can I get these?
You guys want to swap books?
Yeah, I'll definitely send you one. I'd love to.
Besides through coffeewithkenobi.com, we have an Amazon menu, and Paul's book, The Star Wars Heresy, is on there. Corey's book, Uncanny Day, is on there. But how else can people find your book, Paul?
They can also go to the McFarlane website. And incidentally, McFarlane Books, they actually work a lot of conventions. As I said, I actually met the person I was talking to at Dragon Con. So at a lot of conventions, they show up. McFarlane just does a lot of great stuff. I mean, it's not cheap. You can get e-reader versions actually pretty much everywhere. My book's on the Google Play Store. It's as you said, at Amazon. It's on BarnesandNoble.com. Pretty much anywhere you can buy books. But McFarlane does some really, really great stuff. I spent like $160 at their booth buying books last year at Dragon Con.
So that's how you got the deal,
but
huh?
Yeah. No, even with my author discount, I still actually paid that much. But yeah, it is really solid stuff. They don't have that much going on Star Wars, and so I'm at some point going to have to do the original trilogy, right? I'm not exactly sure when. But
I'm so happy to hear you say that.
Well, I'm not sure when exactly when I'm going to dive into that, but I've got to do the theme, symbols, and philosophies episodes 4, 5, and 6, using this as a base, as a foundation to build on, because I do think, those three movies are actually stronger with all the parallels and so on and so forth. So I definitely want to do that, but I don't know. I don't know when that's going to come about. I'm terrified of the index, because indexing this puppy was...
Oh, man. I can only imagine. I know what it did. How long it took me to do my thesis.
There you go. I just had to go away for the weekend and get to a hotel and set out by the pool, and I did my indexing, a lot of my indexing there.
Well, that was a good idea.
It was about to just kind of make my head explode. So I'm thinking about rewriting one of my young adult ones at the moment, but we'll see where it all goes. But I'm sure I'll do the original trilogy at some point.
Yeah, it helps when there's plenty to do with the Clone Wars as well.
Exactly. And then, of course, there's that other episode 7, 8, 9 that I hear Taylor is coming out.
Yeah, I've heard rumblings about that.
Okay, can I tell you guys one story?
Sure, go right ahead.
Please do.
Okay. This is the way it went down. I had Genesis, I think, on Saturday, and I mailed it off to the publishers, and then I worked like all day Sunday and Monday, and then Tuesday I had off, so I'm like, okay, I'm really tired, and I never take a nap in the middle of the day, but I'm just like, I'm just going to lie down and I'm going to take a nap. And I lied down, and literally my phone started buzzing, and I think it buzzed like the next 4 or 5 hours straight between like text messages and Facebook and everything else, because Disney had bought Lucasfilm and episodes 7, 8, and 9 were coming out. And this was literally like 2 days after I finished the book.
Wow.
Yeah. And the world turned upside down, and it kind of made my afterward maybe a little less relevant. But, I don't know about the Disney Star Wars. We'll see. I think that's going to be a very much a new thing. As I've said, I think I pretty much had my finger on a lot of the Lucasfilm Star Wars stuff and George Lucas himself with this new era. I don't know.
Here, I'm very enthusiastic about it. They've done nothing so far but be respectful and reverential thing, and they're putting out quality products, and they're really pushing what the fans value about Star Wars. And
yeah, if I can, if somebody can write a a book analyzing the theme symbols and philosophies of episodes 7, 8, 9. You know, that'll definitely be a good time. I mean, I'm cautiously optimistic. I just kind of feel like we're in new waters, and that I'm not particularly familiar with. So I'll just kind of have to see. I mean, it was sad when it's like they canceled Detours and then 1313 and then 3D releases, and then the real blow was, of course, the Clone Wars. And it just seemed like we were losing a lot of stuff for a while. You know, they said, you know, we have all this new stuff coming out, but we just got caught in that limbo. Yeah, we'll see how it goes.
Absolutely. Hey, Paul, you mentioned that you do write other books. What are some of the other books that are upcoming from you?
Well, as I said, the young adult ones, I really tried to get an agent for, and there's some interest on both of them. They never did particularly find an agent for them, so they're not really published. I'm thinking about going back and rebooting basically the last one that I did. So that's pretty much the only book actually that I have out at the moment.
Very good. Well, we will certainly advertise that on our website and our show notes. And again, we are so excited that we had you on to talk to the Star Wars Heresies, and we've had a lot of great emails from people asking about the book, and hopefully this gave just a sample of all the great things that are out there for people who want to check it out. It really is an amazing, like the ultimate Star Wars textbook, and to me that's a positive thing. It's just completely rid of analytical prowess, looking at the prequels in such a great way that probably a lot of people hadn't thought of before, or maybe they even have more things that will be expanded upon because of your ideas. So we thank you so much, and we certainly couldn't let you go. Oh, our pleasure. And we certainly couldn't let you go without asking you our 5 questions that we ask everybody when their coffee cup is almost empty.
Right. Well, fire away.
Okay, Paul, the first question is, what's your favorite Star Wars movie?
My favorite Star Wars movie? I will go with The Revenge of the Sith. I'm not going to say The Empire Strikes Back. Actually, Return of the Jedi is probably my favorite from the original trilogy. But yeah, we'll go with Revenge of the Sith. We'll give Sith some love.
Very good. The best prequel, I think. Now, who is
and
your
Camille
favorite
character? Camille Paglia agrees with you. I don't know if you've seen any of her stuff. Glittering Images, she actually wrote a book on tracing art basically back from, you know, Mesopotamia to the present, and she names Revenge of the Sith as one of the greatest works of art that have been done, so that was kind of neat.
Oh, cool.
I had seen that. I don't know if it's something that you would put on Facebook or what, but I had
probably
seen it. Pretty cool.
Yeah, I actually quoted her in the book a few times.
Yes, absolutely. That's the one. That's why I bring up my... Who is your favorite character?
I have a lot of favorite characters. I so wanted to be Han Solo when I was a kid. And Luke Skywalker probably reigns supreme. But I certainly have a fondness in my heart for Qui-Gon Jinn. I loved all the characters, and I loved all the prequel characters. And actually, I found everybody very, very relatable in their own ways. So, yeah, I guess you put a gun to my head, I guess I would have to say Luke Skywalker. You put a blaster to my head.
There you go.
Are the Rancor Keeper? I don't know. No.
Well, you know,
he was pretty sad. Common. Yeah.
Was. He was moving, you know.
So what's your favorite line of dialogue or film moment?
How about your focus determines your reality?
Ooh, no one's brought up yet. I love that.
I think that's Jimmy Mack's favorite line as well. But yeah, I mean, again, it's Star Wars is so eminently quotable. But yeah, I'll have to give that one to Qui-Gon Jinn.
If you collect, what is your favorite collectible that you own?
I do collect. My collecting actually is pretty sporadic. It basically comes down to space and that sort of thing. I'm looking around. Actually, a friend of mine, Dean Story, who actually helped me on the bibliography in the book, who I mentioned, Star Wars Frames. He got a really great deal on Star Wars Frames, and he gave that to me for a Christmas present, and it is really awesome. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah. We did get a copy of that. Okay.
Isn't it amazing?
It's incredible.
And it also goes to show.
It is.
Just how visually stunning and beautiful the prequels are. I mean, and film being a visual medium, you know, you can't just dismiss that.
The final question is, what particular messages or themes about the Star Wars saga resonate or speak to you?
Wow, there are so many. I didn't even think of it. I didn't even think of this question.
Why don't you just open your book and just pull one of those out of there?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We'll say, we'll just go with letting go again. Because letting go, again, living your life to the fullest, but at the same time, you gotta be open to things, but at the same time, you also have to let things go. Everything comes and goes in your life, and as it says in Ecclesiastes, everything has a season. So we'll leave it there.
Perfect. Well, Paul, thank you again so much for answering our 5 questions, for coming on Coffee with Kenobi to talk about the Star Wars Heresies. fans, listeners, definitely go and check that out and share your insights with Paul and share with us here on Coffee with Kenobi. Paul, where can people get in touch with you if they want to say hi or ask you questions about your great book?
Well, they can go. There's actually the StarWarsHeresies.blogspot.com, and I'm not really updating it that much, unfortunately. But actually, that has links too to where they can buy a copy of my book. You can also just feel free to friend me on Facebook, just Paul F. McDonald.
Well, Paul, thank you again so much for being our special guest on Coffee with Kenobi and talking about your amazing book, The Star Wars Heresies. We certainly look forward to chatting with you in the future.
Well, thank you guys for having me on. It's been an absolute honor. Again, this is my first time, but I really appreciate it. And you guys have a fantastic podcast. And y'all are out there just elevating the whole fandom in my mind.
Oh, wow. Thanks a lot.
Hey, thank you.
Absolutely. Just really making us think and helping us define the depth and having so many great people on. And it's an honor for y'all to have me on next to Ian Dozier and John Jackson Miller and everybody else, you know? So, thank you.
Absolutely. Well, thank you. That might be one of the nicest things we've heard, so we appreciate that. You're trying to get another cup of coffee out of this.
I'm not a coffee drinker. I'm sitting here with some Dasani water, actually. Sorry.
A water guy. Gotcha.
No, that sounds actually pretty good.
Thanks, okay. Paul. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you, guys. Bye-bye.
Have a great night. Thanks, bud.
All right, you too.
Our topic for show number 18 is The Empire Strikes Back. Scott Murray of Assembly of Geeks returns to help us look at Episode 5 as we continue our series with Scott looking at the six existing Star Wars films in reverse order. What are some of the most important or significant themes in this popular entry in the original trilogy? What aspects of the film resonate with fans? And how does this film stand up against the test of time? In 500 words or less, be sure to send us your thoughts, comments, or an MP3 to feedback@coffeewithkenobi.com.
I like the sound of that.
Echo 3 to Echo 7. Ano, buddy, you read me?
I saw part of the message.
I seem to have found it.
Our first email comes from Jeff Roney, and he writes, "Hello, my name is Jeff Roney. My wife and I host the Once Upon a Time fan podcast. I'm a huge Star Wars fan, as well as a fan of ABC TV's Once Upon a Time. Check out a comedy bit I did for our podcast here." And we'll put that in the show notes. And then he writes, "I mentioned Star Wars Connections and Joseph Campbell's themes quite often in our review and analysis of the episodes. And if any of your listeners enjoy Once Upon a Time, they would enjoy our podcast. Here is a promo.
Lord Vader.
Yes, Commander.
We have received a distress signal.
Is the Rebel fleet massing near Sullust?
No, Lord Vader. It's ABC's Once Upon a Time.
Yes, go on.
Fans of Once Upon a Time have a place to gather, send in theories, and listen to original comedy, too.
Where is this place? Dantooine?
No. It's a weekly broadcast called the Once Upon a Time Fan Podcast. It's on the internet at onceuponatimepodcast.com, hosted by Jeff and Colleen Roney.
What if we don't listen to this podcast?
People might listen to a Honey Boo Boo podcast.
No, this cannot be. Don't underestimate the power of the Boo Boo. Answer their distress signal, assuring them that all Once Upon a Time fans will listen to the Once Upon a Time fan podcast.
Yes, my lord.
Oh, and message the Jedi as well. Tell them that they are our only hope. We must all join in this battle.
I was wondering if you'd be interested in playing it on your podcast or mentioning our podcast on your podcast or blog. Thanks for your consideration, and that's from Jeff. And Jeff, thank you so much. The promo is great, very clever. We'd be honored to play it for you as our listeners just heard. And Jeff has graciously offered to record some audio for us at WonderCon because there's that great Star Wars Rebels panel that's going to happen. So we will definitely look forward to hearing more from Jeff in the future.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of our listeners are also fellow podcasters themselves, and we love hearing about all the different podcasts that are out there, and we love plugging those as well, because we're all fans together about whatever it may be, and we all seem to get along, so we love plugging other folks who enjoy our show as well. Our next email comes from A.E. Welling, and it says, "Hello, fellows. First, this is going to be long. I can think of no short way through it. I had to listen to show number 16 twice. It really got me with some thoughts, and I got to write them and share with you. Consider mention a sense entitlement. Among certain, our various groups of fans are just scattered throughout Star Wars fans generally. And she mentioned that it was new. I will agree to disagree with that. Those kinds of thoughts have been around since the release of Episode 1, I think. The sense of entitlement goes hand in hand with the sense of ownership we all have as fans. These can be both good and bad. The ownership we have as if we are to collect or costume or build astromechs. Since we cannot go directly to the galaxy far, far away, we do these things in place of that, to have or be a small part of it. This would be ownership. Great stuff, as I had just had one heck of a collection, a different tree in a different forest. Mostly good, especially if one has the funding. Now, the entitlement. In my opinion, this comes for more from wanting the story to go away we'd like it to go. After having so much Star Wars for so many years, starting with the Expanded Universe stuff before the prequel trilogy, even a lot of it after, it seems so many would like the story to go this way or go that way, and after having been attached to it for so long. Now, the story. As far as six films are concerned, it is a story created by one man and shared with the whole galaxy. Quotes can be found of Mr. Lucas saying, "That's the story," after Phantom Menace and Attack of Clones, in response to some fans' dislike of the films. Now it's happening again. Years later, we learn that there will be the long-said next three films that were based on Mr. Lucas' story. He shared the story with all of us, but does that entitle us to anything? Past, present, or yet to be? All these rumors help none of this. A year or two after Star Wars: A New Hope was shown, we learn there will be the next Star Wars movie. I do not recall hearing anything like, "It'll be better than this," or "It'll be better than that." Not even when we learned there will be a third film. I entirely feel like I agree with all that Kinsella had said and felt. Whew, now I think I got down all my thoughts. See you on the radio, A.E. Welling.
This email brings up a lot of the great times and discussions we have with Kinsella and the sense of entitlement that fans have where George Lucas creates this incredible saga and people love it, but they also feel a sense of ownership and entitlement, and we will certainly see a lot of that possessive nature, the attachment nature that Paul talked about in our discussion when 7, 8, 9 come out in the spinoff films. So, good points there. I think it's the fact that we're getting new Star Wars is great. Doesn't mean you just accept whatever is given to you without a critical lens, because that wouldn't be what we're about either. But embracing the joy of the prospect of what is to come and not dwelling on what might not be perfect in our own minds, because there are a lot of Star Wars fans out there with a lot of opinions, which is why shows like ours, the Cantina Cast and the Force Cast and all these other great Star Wars podcasts out there, Star Wars Kids Cast, and these are all great ways for fans to express themselves. We're happy that A.E. Willing sent this along.
Absolutely, and I agree with you, Dan. I think having a sense of entitlement is something that's kind of risen within the last, you know, 10 or 20 years because of the invention of the internet too. Everybody seems to have a voice, and
yeah,
and it's very skewed. I mean, anything that, you know, Hollywood puts out there, or an actor has been attached to some film that, you know, you don't agree with, you know, it's and obviously it's going to go the way that the, you know, they're paying money to build this movie out of, and they're going to do it whether we, you know, we like it or not as fans, or we're entitled to have our opinion. And I certainly hope that folks would get their voices heard. And I think that as far as the internet goes, it's kind of a bashing station as far as just groups of people just jumping on the bandwagon and just hating on things. And we tend to forget that we're getting new films, we're getting new fandom, we're getting new all kinds of new stuff, and we should be enjoying that and just for what it is, and whether it's announced or just rumored for certain things, just enjoy it. I think that fans are just are great people that be able to, like you said, that they can be able to dress up or costume or write or do all kinds of stuff as far as their fandom goes, and I think that's a really great way to express yourself. But anybody who wants to send in an MP3 or an email, you know, saying, "Hey, we love your show," or "How about this idea?" I think that's great. That's the whole reason we have this show.
I agree. I totally agree. I think it's wonderful. It's why we do it. It's we want to give fans a voice, just like we want to have a voice in fandom. It's exactly what we're all about.
Chewie, get us out of here!
If you would like to respond to our question of the show, have a comment, or just want to say hello, send us an email or MP3 at feedback@coffeewithkenobi.com. Or if you have a specific question or comment for either of us individually, email us at danz@coffeewithkenobi.com or coreyc@coffeewithkenobi.com, or visit us at coffeewithkenobi.com and click on the Contact Us section, or comment on one of the stories featured on the site. If you enjoy the show, please write a review in iTunes. You can also like the show on Facebook at facebook.com/coffeewithkenobi, as well as keep up to date on our Twitter feed at twitter.com/coffeewithkenobi. You can also find us on Tumblr at coffeewithkenobi.tumblr.com. If you enjoy the jazz music, download the album Eye to Eye by Steve Torok on iTunes.
Give the evacuation code signal.
That's it for show number 17 of Coffee with Kenobi. A big thank you to Paul F. McDonald for having a cup of coffee with us and for discussing his incredible book, The Star Wars Heresies. Be sure to purchase a copy of his book today directly from our website or from the publisher, McFarland.
Thanks to Paul for an amazing discussion, Rob of the Bearded Trio, to everyone who contributed to this show, and to all of you out there who listened to and email Coffee with Kenobi. Don't forget to send us your comments and opinions on the topic for show number 18, The Empire Strikes Back.
This is the podcast you're looking for.
This podcast is not endorsed by the Walt Disney Company or Lucasfilm LTD and is intended for entertainment and informational purposes only. The official Star Wars website can be found at starwars.com. Star Wars, all names and sounds and any other Star Wars related items are registered trademarks and or copyrights of Disney and their respective trademark and copyright holders. All original content of this podcast is the intellectual property of Coffee with Kenobi unless otherwise indicated.
There's no one here. Move along. Move along.